Hi, I'm Bob Moon. What if instead of laying people off, companies cut payroll by reducing hours and the state picked up some of the difference? It's called WorkShare, and it seems to be, well, working.
You don't really like letting people go because it's your trained workforce. Let's say in 6 or 7 months, we need these people back. They may or may not be available.
Plus, the value of unbiased information when it comes to picking which stocks to invest in.
You know, we're not beholden to anybody, so we can say what we really think.
How the dot-com bust and boom led to some research you can trust. And if you're fresh out of college and struggling to make ends meet, why a housekeeper may not be such a bad idea.
I remember coming home and just thinking, oh my God, the floors are done. The shower is, like, less moldy. This is incredible.
Ah, yes, the trials and tribulations of Generation Y. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. I've got one word for you, just one word. Plastic. Yeah, as in credit cards. Seems a growing number of stores would prefer you stop using plastic. I'm Bob Moon in for Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at Thrivent.com.
If you dropped by your local 7-Eleven lately, you might have noticed something amid the glossy gossip rags and energy shots. A petition. It's a protest against the fees the credit card companies charge the stores every time we use plastic. Small business owners across the country say those hidden charges are taking a big gulp out of their profits. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
It's about 400 degrees in downtown Los Angeles today. Perfect Slurpee weather.
$153.
I have cash somewhere in the greater depths of my purse, but it's easier to just swipe my card. I don't even have to sign.
Thank you.
Actually, it's Visa that should be thanking me. 7-Eleven just had to pay them about 11 cents so I could charge my Slurpee. It's called an interchange fee, and it works like this. Every time I use my Visa card, the merchant who takes it pays the credit card company a flat fee, usually about a dime. The card company also gets about 2% of the purchase price. So for that $1.53 Slurpee, 7-Eleven paid Visa 11 cents. That's almost 10% of the price. Gunu Singh owns the 7-Eleven.
This store alone pays over $28,000 in credit card fees. And for us, I mean, that would translate to hiring another person from the community.
Singh says the fees aren't just expensive, they're extremely confusing. Visa's interchange rate is about 1%, plus the 10-cent flat fee. American Express charges 1.5%, plus its flat fee. Rewards cards have higher fees. Debit cards have lower fees. Jeff Leonard is with the National Association of Convenience Stores. He says all those fees totaled $48 billion last year.
The credit card companies get together twice a year. They say, okay, this is the rate for this. This is the rate for this. If you don't like it, don't take them.
Interchange fees have tripled since 2002, and retailers, who have already been hammered by the recession, are now seeing interchange fees eating into what little profits they have left, says Mallory Duncan with the National Retail Federation.
After you take out the cost of merchandise, rent, employees, benefits, and all the other costs that go in running a retail store, the typical profit margin is 2%. That means most retailers only take home $2 on $100 of sales. Now, the card companies are asking for that same $2.
In his 7-Eleven in Santa Clara, California, franchisee Long Nguyen has already gotten about 1,000 customers to sign his petition protesting interchange fees. He says it's easy to make his case once customers realize they have something at stake.
Is it going to really affect me? That's their main question. I said, look, it does, because at some point I have to pass on the goods. Now your milk costs more because I have to make these margins somewhere.
But these merchants are leaving something out of the equation, says Peter Garuccio, spokesman for the American Bankers Association, which represents credit card issuers.
The key to remember or realize is the enormous benefit that merchants get from accepting plastic.
Garuccio points out that taking cards brings business to retailers. And the banks that issue the cards take on the risk of the purchase. So if I don't pay my Visa bill, 7-Eleven still gets the money for my Slurpee. There's legislation in the works that might let 7-Eleven keep more of that money. Congress is looking into interchange fees, and the Senate has introduced antitrust legislation aimed at credit cards.
I hate those credit card fees. They jack up the prices on food and drinks and chips and, you know, everything else in the store.
That's shopper Justin Rose. He says he signed petitions at several 7-Elevens. 7-Eleven hopes to deliver 1 million signatures, including several from Justin, to Capitol Hill next month. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Thank you.
By the way, we've heard from quite a few business owners about their struggle to deal with credit card merchant fees. Their observations are posted with Stacey's story on our website. You can add your comments there, too. Just go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
There was more bad news for credit card issuers this week, and here's why we should all care. Whether you know it or not, you could easily become the target of something called an arbitration process. That's an out-of-court alternative to resolving disputes. And it's such a favorite with the credit card companies that before they'll do business with you, you have to give up your right to go to court and abide instead by arbitration. This week, though, the company responsible for deciding most of the country's arbitration cases, and which, by the way, nearly always ruled in favor of the credit card companies, threw in the towel. That was the National Arbitration Forum's way of settling a lawsuit brought by Minnesota's Attorney General. Then the country's second biggest arbitration provider halted business this week, too. Minnesota's Attorney General says the arbitration process is stacked in favor of the credit card companies. Lori Swanson joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on, Bob.
So how did this all work? A consumer had, say, fallen behind on their credit card or their cell phone bill. At what point would the National Arbitration Forum step in, and why do they have the right to do that?
Well, in the fine print of credit card agreements, pretty much every American citizen has given up their right to have their day in court to dispute any contest over the charges. Instead, just by keeping the credit card, the consumer must resolve the dispute in arbitration by an arbitration company picked by the credit card company.
You alleged in your lawsuit that led to this settlement that they were basically on the side of the creditors. How lopsided were you alleging this was?
It was a very lopsided process. We have marketing materials where the forum told banks and credit card companies, you know, arbitration is going to be great for you. The consumer doesn't know what to expect. And then on the other side, we uncovered a New York hedge fund owned a sizable chunk of the forum, but also owned part of one of the country's biggest debt collection operations. Some of the executives were sending emails saying, you know, there can't be any public information about these ties, that would be a real problem.
Is it not possible that consumers lose as often as you say they do because they simply didn't use their cards or accounts responsibly and they're at fault? There's a judgment against them.
You know, in some cases, absolutely, the consumer does owe the money. There are people who have charged things on their credit card and they owe it. But what this case was really about was fundamental fairness. One party to litigation ought not to have their thumb on the scale of justice pressing it down. There ought to be a right of everybody to show that they don't owe the money.
What about the supporters? Groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce say that this is going to remove a very important option, an option that consumers have that can in many cases be cheaper than going to court.
If a credit card company and a consumer want to agree to arbitration as a way to resolve a dispute, this in no way impedes that. The problem with arbitration is you have one party to the transaction, namely the credit card company, picking the arbitration company, and where the arbitration company also knows that if the arbitration company rules too much on the side of the consumer, that the credit card company can go elsewhere. That type of bias doesn't exist in the court system.
Did any consumer stories strike you as particularly poignant?
Yeah, we had a lot of these cases involving consumers who were victims of identity theft where they simply didn't owe the money, and yet they would try to pass the information on, try to prove their case, and they just couldn't get through. And then certainly the information we heard from the employees, I mean, basically being instructed, make it as difficult as possible for the consumer. You know, that if the credit card company called the arbitration forum, they should bend over backwards, they should help them draft claims, but that if a consumer called, they should get them off the phone as quickly as possible, provide as little help as possible.
We've been talking about credit cards and cell phone bills and that sort of thing, but arbitration really extends to wide areas that consumers might not even know about, such as nursing homes. You might give up your right to sue a nursing home or an insurance company or all sorts of different institutions, right?
Correct. Nursing homes, healthcare. In fact, the National Arbitration Forum was working with this New York hedge fund group to really look at getting into healthcare in a big way. They kind of envisioned that the National Arbitration Forum would really be part of a what they call the comprehensive alternative legal system. Under the agreement that we have with the forum, they can't be involved in any of these types of consumer disputes. So, for example, healthcare would be off the table.
Well, there's certainly a lot more to come on this story, and we'll have to keep watching it. Lori Swanson is the Attorney General of Minnesota. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We talk a lot on this show about credit scores, how to check them, how to raise them, how to avoid taking a big hit on that all-important ranking. Well, Chris Farrell is here with his op-ed, The Straight Story, and get this, he's actually here to say, forget all that. There's an even more fundamental number we should all be worrying about.
Your net worth. Do you know it? I'll bet most of you don't. In theory, the net worth equation is simple. You add up the value of your home, your retirement savings plans, your savings accounts, and any other asset that could be sold and turned into cash. You then tally up everything you owe, from your mortgage to your car loan to the balance you carry on your credit card. Your net worth is your assets minus those liabilities. Of course, the basic idea may be simple, but it takes a lot of time and effort to gather all that information. If you're like me, you have an account here and a debt there and, well, your record keeping might be a bit haphazard. I think that's why many people don't bother with the calculation. The good news is that there are plenty of worksheets in the library or bookstore to help guide you. Even better are the online resources, sites like Mint.com and NetWorthIQ.com, that are increasingly easy to use and update. The net worth calculation gives you a good idea of how well you're doing overall. If you have more assets than liabilities, you have what's called a positive net worth. You have a negative net worth if the total amount you owe is more than you own. One advantage of figuring out the number is that it forces you not to ignore the bad stuff. A few years ago, many people didn't worry about their net worth. The unhappy history of recent events proves it's vital to have an accurate gauge of your overall financial situation. A note of caution, let's not turn your net worth figure into another obsession like the credit score. A number of bloggers follow their net worth by the month. I find it intriguing to follow, but as part of my research as a financial journalist, for most people, it should be a check-in you do every once in a while, like a physical exam. The reason I like net worth is that gathering the data and knowing your net worth forces you to grapple with all aspects of your financial life. To me, it's a critical database or foundation for sensible financial planning.
Coming up, when you work a double shift, the last thing you want to do is come home and clean. But what if not everyone's on board with hiring a maid?
It's Wednesday morning, and I am now going to wash the dishes before the housekeeper gets here.
Paying to have the house cleaned is a luxury to some and essential for others. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's no easy task finding trustworthy opinions, let alone hard information about a particular stock. A settlement after the dot-com bust was supposed to make that easier for average investors. Wall Street firms settled for more than $400 million, which was put toward unbiased stock research. The deal expires at the end of this month, though, and Marketplace's Amy Scott has been looking into what that means for investors.
Take your mind back, way back before most of us knew anything about mortgage-backed securities or credit default swaps. There was another big scandal on Wall Street.
This has been only about one thing. It has been about ensuring that retail investors get a fair shake.
That's former New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer in 2002. He accused investment banks of hyping the stocks of some companies in order to win more business from them. Spitzer concluded that when those banks advised their clients to buy, hold, or sell a stock, they didn't always have the investors' best interests at heart.
Retail investors know there is no guaranteed return in the market. They know there is risk. But the one thing they deserve is honest advice and fair dealing. That is what this deal is designed to produce.
The deal was a massive settlement with the big investment banks. They agreed to pay nearly $1.5 billion in total penalties. They had to spend a chunk of that money to give their clients a second opinion on stocks from independent research firms. That is, firms that don't do any investment banking.
That's really what it was all about. It was really providing a second opinion that was objective to retail investors so retail investors could make better investment decisions.
Michael Mayhew is founder of Integrity Research Associates. It's a research firm that tracks other research firms. He says the money helped several independent companies get off the ground or expand. One of them is Morningstar in Chicago. On a recent morning, analysts chatted over coffee about prospects for an economic recovery.
Some of them are commodities. It's just an overall picture of what might be helpful.
Morningstar analysts now research some 2,000 companies and rate their stocks. That work is funded in part by money from the Wall Street settlement. Catherine Oodleboo is president of the Equity Research Group. She says because Morningstar doesn't do any investment banking, it doesn't have conflicts of interest.
You know, we're not beholden to anybody, so we can say what we really think.
Some have questioned how much individual investors really used the information paid for by the settlement. The Wall Street Journal reported that in 1 year at Credit Suisse, just 16 retail investors accessed reports on the bank's website. But Oodleboo says the brokers at these investment banks read the reports and pass them on to their clients. And she says more information helps everybody.
In general, I think the more voices, the better. If there's just one or two opinions out there, you don't necessarily get the most thoughtful discussion.
Analyst Michael Mayhew says those extra voices have helped force so-called sell-side research, opinions issued by investment banks, to become more objective. He says the big banks are more likely to recommend selling a stock than they were before the settlement. But he says when the money from the settlement dries up at the end of this month, that could change.
Without that lever of independent research, does sell-side research become more biased? We don't know, but that's certainly one of my concerns when we look at the end of the settlement.
The money won't disappear entirely. Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney say they'll continue to offer their clients a second opinion even after the settlement expires. Individuals will still be able to pay for Morningstar's reports on its website. But Mayhew says the downturn on Wall Street has forced a lot of banks to cut back on their own stock research. Just when investors could really use some guidance they can trust, they might find it harder to get. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
It's got to be tough being a boss these days, delivering the grim news in bundles of pink slips. But as strange as it sounds, that might be the easiest part of riding out a recession. The real challenge comes in not cutting too deeply and then trying to anticipate just the right time to gear back up. Some 20 states are giving employers a less disruptive option aimed at limiting their layoffs up front. Enrolled companies cut work hours, but the state picks up some of the difference with unemployment benefits. Kathy Ducharme has this profile of a Maryland company that's sharing the economic burden with a program called WorkShare.
We're on the factory floor of the independent can company. Workers here make decorative tins that hold everything from Hershey's chocolate to Zippo lighter fluid. The pounding presses give you the sense that business is good. Not so, says human resources manager Dan Daniels. Orders are way down. The second shift has been canceled. Daniels recalls last spring when permanent layoffs became a possibility for the first time in the company's 80-year history.
You don't really like letting people go because it's your trained workforce. Because let's say in 6 or 7 months, we need these people back. They may or may not be available. And if not, then we're starting from scratch again. It's about a 7-month process to teach somebody how to run one of our can lines.
So how do you keep skilled workers and at the same time cut payroll? The answer for Independent Can was WorkShare. Here's how it works. Companies that enroll in WorkShare can shave a 5-day work week to 3. Employers pay for the hours worked. Employees collect unemployment benefits based on the percent of hours cut. It's less money, but that's okay with Sandy Irie. The HR coordinator at Independent Can went down from 5 days a week to 4.
I love it. I really do. Last week on my day off, I was running errands, and lady at the counter in the card shop apologized for keeping me waiting. I said, "That's okay." I said, "I'm not in a hurry." I thought, how refreshing.
Irie is the first to admit it's a different story for many workers on the factory floor who need all the money they can get. But manager Dan Daniels says WorkShare has helped to keep morale up.
I think it gives everybody a sense that, you know, we're all in this together, and I'm not being singled out and being laid off. You know, what did I do to get laid off involuntarily?
California was the first state to offer WorkShare back in 1978. 17 other states have followed, including Maryland. But in the current recession, WorkShare enrollment is way up. In Maryland, the increase is tenfold.
Right now, unfortunately, for us, business is good, and that's usually not good for everybody else.
That's Tom Wendell. He runs the Maryland State Unemployment Program. Wendell says WorkShare is a good way for companies to get through a slump. But he worries about the strain the recession is putting on the trust fund that pays out unemployment benefits.
Maryland has a little bit over $500 million in a trust fund right now, so we're looking relatively good compared to a lot of states. But money goes quickly. We're paying out almost $35 million a week right now.
WorkShare is only a small part of that payout. In fact, Wendell says only a fraction of companies eligible for WorkShare sign on to the program. And WorkShare can't always prevent layoffs. At Independent Can, 21 people, about 9% of the company's workforce, were told in June they no longer had jobs. In Belcamp, Maryland, I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show when we answer your questions. Our personal finance guru, Chris Farrell, is here with me to do just that. So let's get going, Chris, shall we?
Absolutely.
First, we have Marie on the line from Bothell, Washington. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question for us today?
Well, here's our situation. My husband and I have never really before been in a position to purchase our home. We had planned to do so now, and we've even come close to making a couple of offers, but we only have about 3% to put down. Our monthly payments will take all the money we have coming in for the first couple of years. The tricky part is that we have a child who is going to be ready for college in just 5 years, and nothing saved up for that yet.
Mm-hmm. This has got to be a question that's confronting a lot of people out there right now, Chris. It's a tempting housing market. There are deals to be had out there. Is it worth scrimping to this degree?
I don't think so. You know, being house poor is no fun. Putting all your money into that home is not a good situation. So my sense is you're stretching too far to own. It's not a good idea.
And what about these questions about sending the kid to college? That seems even more complicated.
Oh, it does. And it adds an extra layer to the whole issue because part of it has to do with values. I mean, kid goes off to college. Now, you could decide they can borrow and they'll pay it off with future earnings. All right. Well, that then might say, well, I got a little more money here for home ownership, but you might have another value. And that says, you know, I'm really going to help them pay for college so that they graduate with as little debt as possible. And that says, owning that home, too expensive. Toss in one other thing, Bob. There's nothing wrong with renting. One of the biggest lies in the real estate business is that renting is throwing your money away. In this case, sounds to me like renting means you can help your child pay for college.
A word to the wise. Does that help you out, Marie?
It does, really. You've given us some more information and a little more to think about, and I really appreciate the advice. Thank you.
Okay, great. Bye-bye. Next, we have Thomas in San Francisco, California. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Can I call you Tom?
Yes, of course.
How can we help you today?
Well, I have a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Someone at one time told me that if I paid a little bit extra towards the interest on that loan each month, I would save a considerable amount overall over the term of the loan. So I've been religiously paying about $200 extra each month. And it occurred to me that I really have no idea how much I'm actually going to be saving over the term of the loan by doing this.
Chris, I know that's a good idea when you're paying off a credit card. What about this? Is it a good idea in this case?
Yes, it is a good idea. There's a calculator site I mention a lot, dickytown.net. Go there and you put in the terms of your mortgage, and then you put in what's the extra payment that you're going to put in, and then it gives you how much you're going to save, how much you'll cut the life of the mortgage. So, for example, I was just playing around with it. It would be you'd cut the mortgage life down by about over 7 years and save about $66,000 in interest.
Okay.
All right. So that's pretty good. Then what I would do, though, is raise the question, well, what if I made what's called the 13th monthly payment a year? And you write on that check to the bank and you say, put toward principal. Would that be a better move than doing what I'm doing in terms of just putting the extra $200?
Okay, and banks in general are happy to accept that 13th payment as against principal?
Oh, absolutely. But you just have to write on the check for principal only. You can just do it on your own. Then by paying off the mortgage, what's your rate on your mortgage, Tom?
It's 5.375.
Okay, so you make a 5.3% return on investment.
Right.
Not bad.
No, it's better than most other things available out there right now. Certainly better than savings or money market.
Thomas, I hope we shed some light on your question today.
Yes, you did. Just exactly what information I was looking for. I do appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, if you're trying to find a good home for your money, give us a call. You can leave a voicemail with your question anytime at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or you can write us an email. Just find the Getting Personal link on marketplace.org. We'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now, just when you think you've heard everything, a story like this next one comes along. Maybe to you and me, domestic help sounds like a luxury, even more so in times like these. Housekeeping services say they have lost clients, but it turns out they've also had a steady stream of new ones. This is the now I've heard it all part. Some are students and recent college grads paying to have their dorm rooms kept clean. Yeah, that's how I reacted too. Sally Herships has the story.
It's Wednesday morning, and I am now going to wash the dishes before the housekeeper gets here.
Yeah, you heard me correctly. I'm cleaning up before the housekeeper. Why? Flash back a couple of months. I had a talk with one of my roommates, Kara, help clean up our tiny New York City apartment or else.
You're freaking out.
But you guys weren't cleaning up.
I work 12 hours a day, and the last thing I want to do when I get home is clean the toilets.
So my two roommates hired a housekeeper instead for $150 a month. I found it embarrassing, which is why I clean before the housekeeper arrives. My roommates are in their mid-20s. Yes, mid-20s. Why do they need to hire help? I'm a bit older, but am I old-fashioned? I asked my friend Shayna. Like me, she's in her 30s. Her sister just graduated from college and has a housekeeper.
There is a sense of entitlement among some of her friends and peers and that I have a real hard time relating to.
So what is going on with the kids these days? I asked Kit Yarrow. She's a professor of psychology and marketing. She's also a stepmom. She just wrote a book about Generation Y. That's people ages 9 to 30, like her two kids, my roommates, and Shayna's sister.
In general, they've been indulged more than previous generations have.
Yarrow says Gen Y is seen as being more knowledgeable about products than previous generations, so they weren't given a lot of influence over household purchases like electronics. And she says, more than other generations, their parents wanted to be their friends, so they ended up with a lot of money to spend, like one high school grad she spoke to.
And I asked her, you know, tell me about a purchase that you really liked that you made to get ready for college. And she said she got a Chanel handbag, and I just about fell off my seat.
I can understand a Chanel handbag, but why a housekeeper? To find out, I talked to Shayna's sister, 22-year-old Kelsey.
This is a luxury for us. This is the splurge.
Now Kelsey has a full-time job, but when she and her roommates hired their housekeeper, they were still in college. At first, she says she was hesitant. Her share of the monthly bill was $70. That seemed too expensive for something she could do herself. But then...
I remember coming home and just thinking, oh my God, the floors are done. The shower is, like, less moldy. This is incredible.
And she says they don't own cars, they cook at home and don't go out much. Kelsey's roommate Tara says the majority of her income is spent on rent and utilities. So a housekeeper, it's almost like an investment.
When you consider how much you're putting in for where you're living, it doesn't seem so extravagant to put in a little bit more so that all three of us can live comfortably. But I would say that it's embarrassing to tell people that we have a housekeeper.
Yeah. Like, it is outrageous, but, you know, we all do outrageous things.
But we don't take cabs.
No. Or go out to fancy dinners.
So, back to psychologist Kit Yarrow. Do you have a maid? Do you have a housekeeper?
Yes.
And when did...
I'm old, though. I got my housekeeper when I was 40. Until I was kind of, like, financially knew what was going to happen, I didn't feel comfortable spending money.
Gen Y does feel comfortable.
They didn't have much money in the stock market, so there wasn't much to lose. They didn't have homes, so there wasn't as much to lose. You know, there's kind of a natural, also completely understandable reason why they haven't pulled back on spending as much.
So what is Gen Y cutting back on right now?
Big blank silence over here.
Big blank silence. Actually, Yarrow says Gen Yers have cut back on pricey purchases, but they're not cutting back on much.
It's not so much that they're selfish or greedy, which is, I think, what we think of when we think of entitled people. It's more like they haven't felt fear.
Unlike us Gen Xers and baby boomers. But Kelsey and her roommate Tara say they're planning to take on their own cleaning and cancel their service. And as for me, all my extra dimes are going into my piggy bank. So for right now, if my roommates want to hire their own cleaning person, that's fine. But I'll stick with my own elbow grease. It's free. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, consider the comic book superhero. We really love them for their human side. Spend a day with a guy who creates those characters. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Let me bounce a familiar slogan off you and have you decide if it has quite the same ring nowadays as a persuasive pitch for financial services. When banks compete, you win. That's what LendingTree.com has been telling us for years, but I probably don't need to elaborate on why the words banks and you win don't exactly fit together like peanut butter and jelly lately, which may explain why LendingTree's taken a new tack. Their motto now, you to the rescue.
Well, old chum, it appears dark days are upon us. Men of ill repute have created a downturn of diabolical proportions. It's time to rise and take control of your own financial destiny.
Yes, that's just an average Joe pictured in these new LendingTree TV spots. But in the mirror, he's got a spandex suit and a superhero mask, and he looks ready to throw off those Wall Street ne'er-do-wells and wield control over his own money. LendingTree.com CEO Doug Lebda says he is you.
We think that nobody has the same vested interest in your financial health than you do.
Are you tapping into some sort of groundswell that you've turned up in research? Is there truly a shift in consumer attitudes?
I think so. I think in two particular areas, we're seeing consumers increasingly, they don't just want choice. They still want to be empowered. They still want to be at the center, but now they also want the right answer. It's more importantly, we think now, to actually help guide them to what is most appropriate for them. The other thing I think we're seeing is a return to financial responsibility at the individual consumer level. We see it in the broader economy with savings rates increasing. We see it with people spending less money.
But should we really all be doing this ourselves? We advocate personal responsibility, but it can be pretty tough to navigate this stuff. Southern California-based financial planner Robert Pagliarini is the author of several books on this subject. Now, to be upfront, you're a financial planner, so you have a vested interest in people not just using the free services at LendingTree.com. That said, what do you think about the message in their ads?
Firstly, I would say that these ads are brilliant because there is just so much fear and skepticism and, I would say, anger about Wall Street, about the stock market crash. So this idea that you can rise up and take control of your financial future, I mean, that sounds great. We all want to be empowered. And you could probably do it to about 80, 85% where it's pretty good. But if you really want to get that edge, the other 15% or so, you really need someone that lives it and breathes it and keeps up with all of the latest news and regulations.
Robert, what's the difference between a site like LendingTree and sitting down in front of a financial planner? They say that they've factored in all the different answers that that you could give them and will come up with the right answer. What's the difference?
It's really night and day, and one is not better than the other. You could do both. Basically, with a site like LendingTree, it's very specific as far as what they do. They're focused on loans, credit cards, mortgages, and they'll shop through their various sources and try to get you the best deal. Now, with a financial advisor, they're looking at everything. They're looking at your cash flow and budgeting, looking at your estate plan, insurance needs, the entire picture.
And you might ask a question that the do-it-yourselfer might not think to ask.
Well, exactly. And, you know, so many people want the right answer. But truly, I think the real benefit of working with an advisor is that they'll ask you the right questions and questions that you just have probably never even considered before.
How much do you think that there is an element of the financial institutions maybe wanting to shift the onus away from their own advice to the individual person? Maybe put the liability on their shoulders? Well, you made those decisions. That's your fault?
Well, I think you really have two different business models right now. You have a lot of brokers or financial advisors. And certainly their pitch is, you don't want to do it alone. Come to us. We've got the experience. We can help you out. And I think they would be really hard-pressed to then try to shift the liability to the investor, because their whole approach is that, you know, come to us, trust us. We've got the experience. We can help you through this. So I think it would be really hard for them to shift some of the liability. But then on the flip side, the other business model is this do-it-yourself approach. And that right now is actually a brilliant approach, because again, so many people are just upset and they feel almost burned by Wall Street. Of course, for those companies, the liability really does rest on the individual's shoulders. They're making the decisions. Ultimately, they decide what happens. And the companies offering these tools, again, it's just information. And so that's where I could see that some of the liability definitely would be shifted to the individual.
Robert Pagliarini is a Southern California-based financial planner. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
Hey, by the way, did you notice who was doing the voice in LendingTree's new superhero ad? If the name Adam West doesn't ring a bell.
You filthy criminals. You abominable outlaws.
You might recognize him as Batman from the campy TV series. And if you knew that, you probably didn't need me to tell you what's going on this weekend in San Diego, California. This weekend is the comic happening of the year, Comic-Con. It's the 40th anniversary of the event, and in this installment of Day in the Work Life, we catch up with a comic book writer who's spending his weekend among the fans.
My name's Joshua Dysart, and I write comic books, and I'm currently doing work for DC Vertigo and Dark Horse Comics. How I broke in was through self-publishing. I was a script supervisor many, many years ago for a very small, very unsuccessful production company. And the person who ran that company fell in love with a comic book artist, which is not recommended, by the way. And they needed somebody to write their very first comic book for them.
Hi,
I'll go through the writing process, which is pretty solitary. The editor will be working with us really aggressively as far as making sure the story's tight, making sure the team is in place. Your team will consist of a letterer, an artist, possibly a colorist if we do the book in color, and an editor. It's literally daily emails and the artist turning in about a page a day. I think what makes a good story is a strong humanist element. Understanding that you're writing about people. Those people can fly, they can be possessed by demons, they can run multinational crime organizations, but if you make them people, I think the reader will identify and respond to it. I think that's more important than plot or narrative or anything else. I'm doing a book called Unknown Soldier for Vertigo, which takes place in northern Uganda in 2002 during the war between the Ugandan People's Defense Force and the Lord's Resistance Army. And I went to East Africa for a month and a half to do research, so I took 1,400 photographs. Alberto Ponticelli was able to take those photographs and draw a completely genuine Gulu town in northern Uganda, and it's taken the book above and beyond. This is the book that is nominated for an Eisner at this year's San Diego Comic-Con. The Eisners are like our Oscars. I wrote for 2 years a character called Swamp Thing. Swamp Thing is a plant with a human consciousness. Like many comic book ideas, it sounds pretty silly when you lay it out in a blueprint sentence like that, but it's about a spirit trapped in matter. And that's the experience that all of us on this planet go through. You know, we're all moving around as spirits trapped in matter and trying to wrestle with that. I really think it comes down to the strength of the idea and the power of the imagination behind it. I am able to support myself writing comic books. I prioritize where I want to spend my money. I spend money on living in a beautiful place. Inversely, I don't have a car. I probably make, you know, I never really thought about this, and I'm a freelancer, so it fluctuates, but I think my biggest year was probably $70,000. And I think last year I made something like $45,000writing comics. And you very much have to believe and have faith in freelancer magic, which is whenever things are really, really bad, something amazing and beautiful is going to come across your table. One of the benefits of doing this is the lifestyle of being a creative freelancer from your home. Where I work, I have 2 10-foot-long windows. One faces the Pacific Ocean. The other faces a walkway that humanity pours down towards Venice Beach. This is the window that I sit and ponder the fate of Conan from. I can't go back to not working in my boxers. There's no alarm clock in my life, which was always my definition of success. I take a nap whenever I want. As long as I'm sitting in my chair and I'm clunking out my stories, I can justify this lifestyle. And it is amazing. You can live your life the way you want to and be creative and you can deny the cubicle your soul.
That was comic book writer Joshua Dysart. For links to his work and to watch a video about the collaboration process, just go to our website, marketplace.org. This installment of our Day in the Work Life series was produced by Joss Rogerson. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
We are back with more Getting Personal. Chris Farrell is here with some answers, so Chris, let's get to the questions.
Yes, let's do it.
First, we have Julia in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
What's your question for us today?
I just wanted to know your opinion about wealth managers or financial planners and the kinds of fees they charge. My husband and I, we've been interviewing financial planners, but have been a little bit worried about the kinds of fees, if that's going to be too much money out of our investments.
Julia, what direction have you taken so far?
We've had several accounts, and they're mainly with just your traditional stockbroker, but we feel like we need a little more guidance from a financial planner and also have one person overlooking everything so we get an idea of where we are.
Chris, first, what's in a name? A financial planner, wealth manager, does that matter?
It really does matter because just about anybody can call themselves a financial planner. When I think of financial planner, it's more, as you mentioned, you want more guidance also in terms of, well, how does this retirement savings fit in with our life insurance and our home ownership and some of our longer term goals of what we want to be doing? And that's more what we think about a financial planner.
Right.
Welcome to a very complicated world. This is the way that I cut through it. And this is my suggestion, which is that I take the financial planner seriously. And the designation that I like is a CFP, a certified financial planner. And what that signals is that this person has a broad-based education and they can deal with a lot of different issues that you may face. That's one part of it. The other thing is that I like fee-only planners. It's just an upfront fee. They're not earning money off commissions.
Right.
And that's the arrangement that I like.
People that we have interviewed, each, they do charge a percentage of your assets under management. And it seems like that really would add up over time. What is your opinion about those kind of fees?
Again, there's sort of certain layers. I mean, first of all, and I think one of the things to raise is, do you really need a planner? And that's actually probably the most important question to ask. And in today's world, for many folks, you know, who are dealing with their home, their life insurance, their retirement savings plan, you know, they probably don't need a planner. They may need a planner around certain major life transitions. Children going off to college, you're going to be an empty nester, retirement. You know, that's a big transition. In between those situations, for many people, it's most cost effective to do it yourself. So you go through that whole series of questions first.
Chris, I wonder about the independence of these fee-based planners. You mentioned that you're more likely to get independent advice. On the other hand, what's to, you know, forgive me for being cynical when it comes to money management here. But what's the
it's not being cynical, it's being accurate.
Yeah, what's to prevent them from double dipping here, from giving you advice but at the same time earning commission?
You know, there I think that's where you have to be doing your research. And it would become apparent fairly quickly if they were double dipping. Now, I think more common, Bob, is the situation that Julia's facing, which is, you know, I'm talking about a fee only and you pay a fee for a blueprint, financial advice, estate planning advice. And then the financial advisor may say, now we can also manage your money. And here's what we charge. And typically it's somewhere between 1 and 1.5%, 1.5% being high. You don't have to go with them. You can have an ongoing relationship with them, and you don't have to have them manage your money. But if they do manage your money, there's going to be a fee associated with that. So the real thing is to make sure the menu of fees is clearly laid out. Is it fee only? If I do the management, what's the fee for you managing my money? If there's anything on commission, I want that disclosed. Because most financial planners are a blend, but I like the initial cut of fee only. And then anything else you do, you have to think very seriously, am I getting a big benefit for this additional cost?
Mm-hmm. Does that help you out, Julie?
That does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate
All
your call.
Right.
Okay, Chris, next we have an email from Robert in Ozark, Alabama. He's also looking to cut out the middleman when it comes to money. Robert writes that he owns a stock certificate issued by a company where he used to work, and he's wondering, is there a way to get it cashed out without using a broker?
You know, as far as I know, most of the time, you know, you need to use some sort of middleman, some sort of broker. And I have a feeling the way that he's written this that he might not have a broker. So, you know, you go down to, your bank that has a brokerage arm. A lot of banks do. And you can do the transaction there. It's not going to cost you very much. The other thing is that he owns a stock certificate issued by a company where he used to work. Call the company and say, hey, you know, will you guys cash it in for me? You know, there are some companies that do make a market in their stock, so it's worth a phone call.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have for Getting Personal this week, but you can give us a call anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or write to us. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And on that site, you'll also find Chris's blog, where he's got more answers for you. Chris, thanks for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
Time to cash it in, I guess, but let me just throw my 2 cents in on this. I read this week that so many people have been scraping up all the spare change they've accumulated. Bank vaults around the country are brimful of pennies. Seems in these hard times, a lot of Americans are pinching every cent they can find.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven.
Shoo-be-doo-be.
Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
Shoo-be-doo-be.
The flip side of the coin is it seems casual collectors are having a devil of a time finding many of the freshly minted Lincoln Bicentennial pennies being released this year. That's apparently because the banks have no need to order and circulate many new pennies. If you've just got to have some of those new Honest Abe pennies, you can order some directly from the U.S. Mint, but it'll cost you, yep, a pretty penny. $8.95 for two rolls of 50 cents. Oh, plus $4.95 shipping and handling. Such a deal. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you've ever wanted to help out a friend in need but didn't want the awkwardness in your relationship, try giving anonymously.
You're the charity. Look around your friends and family members in need, and you give to them.
A website for friends to help friends. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Special thanks this week to Jolie Myers. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Bob Moon. Tess will be back next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.